Well, we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 32 of the Survival Podcast, and what a difference a week makes. Last week, well, just to be blunt, it sucked. I had people telling me when I was bitching about the cold on social media, but dude, you live in Texas, and I'm like, yeah, I live in Texas, and it still sucks for cold. Last week, I literally thought maybe somebody relocated me back to where I grew up in central Pennsylvania or something. In fact, one day last week, I was checking the weather, and I'm like, oh, my God, it's going to get that cold. And I looked at it and said, oh, I don't know why, but I had the weather set to Memphis. Memphis, Tennessee, colder than Dallas-Fort Worth. Sure, yeah, okay. Maybe it's not that bad. And I switched it over to Dallas and Fort Worth and all, and it was the same. It didn't get any better. It was brutally cold. Today, it feels more like May than February. It's just absolutely gorgeous outside. I wish it was outside working. But this is work, too, and we have some stuff to talk about today. And today's show was one of those ones I'm like, what can I do that's a little bit different, maybe we've never done before, and really helps people at the homesteader level. And then a word popped in my brain, sweet potatoes. And you might be like, what? Really? Sweet potatoes? Sweet potato sovereignty? Like, this is really like a big topic. This is a huge topic. And I know, like, the elephant in the room is Jack is the keto, almost carnivore guy, and sweet potatoes are carbohydrates, and yes. But I also have an audience of many, many people, and not everybody eats the way I do, and nor do I tell everybody that they should. And there's a place for being able to grow calories. And if you're not going to grow meat and or eggs or dairy, you know, if it's not going to be an animal, then the calories that you're going to grow are going to be carbohydrate-based. So if you want a calorie crop, you need a carbohydrate crop. And for a lot of people, that's something that they're eating anyway. And, you know, if you're going to be eating things like this, then growing your own is a better way. And I grow sweet potatoes almost every year. Last year was the first time in about 13 years, I guess, that I didn't do it. It was just something I didn't get around to making slips in time or whatever. And I just didn't. And I missed not having them. And we don't eat a huge amount of the tubers, but we eat a lot of the greens. I grow a variety called Murasaki, which I'll talk a little bit about today, which is a fantastic sweet potato. Also lower glycemic index, so when we do indulgence, less indulgence. But there is so much you can do with sweet potatoes, so much beyond what people think of. Like, whenever I talk about sweet potatoes at an actual, like, a real-world event, one of the things I ask is, who here's ever eaten a sweet potato that wasn't orange? And, you know, like maybe 10% of the hands go up. Who here has ever eaten sweet potatoes that weren't like mashed up into a casserole or something like that? They're roasted or something like that. And then another 10% of the hands will go up. Like, who here ate sweet potato fries? And like half the hands go up. Well, those aren't mashed. So then they start thinking about it, you know, like who's ever had a white sweet potato here? And no, almost nobody's hand goes up. You know, who's ever had a red sweet potato? Almost nobody's hand goes up. And there are just tons of varieties, and different varieties have different strengths and weaknesses to what we can do with them. We can grow them for our own feed, but they're also great livestock feed. The tubers themselves are great feed for things like hogs. It's a great, great thing you can grow to finish hogs on and really fatten them up because there is quite a bit of sugar in them. We can brew and ferment with sweet potatoes, and they're so easy to propagate. So we're going to be talking about all of that today and how that is a great step in the direction of true sovereignty, food sovereignty on the homestead. If you have a base crop, even if it's not going to be the thing you just want to eat all the time, but you have a base crop, let's say a survival crop, well, then you've got a foundation. And from a foundation, once you build it strong, you can build anything. And there's probably few things in the world that have the geographic range that sweet potatoes do, the ease of propagation that sweet potatoes do, and all of the applications that sweet potatoes do. It's not the only one, but it's definitely one of the best. That's what we'll talk about today. Before we do, let's hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is Above Phone, where you can replace big tech with your own private ecosystem. Your phone spies on you. Your app makers spy on you. Your carrier spies on you. And they collect your data, and then they sell it to anybody that wants to buy it. They pretty much give it to the government, won't ever ask for it. How'd you like to make that all go away? You came with a bub phone. I know you're thinking, Jack, how am I going to do a bub phone, man? I can barely get by with my phone. I'm not technical like you or whatever. Yeah, okay, you think I'm that technical. The truth is that a bub phone is as easy to use as any other phone, like a Android, Google Android, or a iPhone. It's really not that much different to use. A little bit of a learning curve, but the beauty is a bub phone will provide you with an expert. With a one-hour free consultation, after you get your phone, you set up your time, they will walk you through crossing over from the world of big tech controlling you to true freedom above the fray with Above Phone. Next up today is KnifeKits.com. KnifeKits is probably the oldest sponsor we have is still with us. I think KnifeKits first sponsored this show in very early, around February of 2010. That's 15 years of sponsorship in the world of podcasting. That's just kind of insane when you think about it. So check them out today, KnifeKits.com, where you can get everything you need to make knives yourself. If you're a master bladesmith already, you probably know about them, but you can get raw materials. You can get buffalo horn. You can get mammoth tusk. You can get, you know, all different types of steel that you start from on your own. Or, as the name implies, you can kind of get a ready-to-go kit where you just need to pick a few things to finish it out, and it's really easy to do. And anything in between. They also have a great assortment of things like Kydex and other really cool stuff. Check them out today at KnifeKits.com. And with that, let's go ahead and get on into our topic today, which is sovereignty of the sweet potato. And again, I know it sounds like a big claim. You know, sweet potatoes are, you know, a step to food sovereignty or even a foundation of food sovereignty. But they really are. They are one of the most reliable, easy to produce crops that we have, specifically in temperate climate North America. And that includes down into the tropics and subtropics, especially as we kind of go a little bit beyond what we just call a sweet potato into the world of like yams and things and different tubers. Just about anywhere you can go in North America, there are sweet potatoes or yams and similar tubers that you can grow. And they all propagate the way we're going to talk about today, and they all can be used in the way that we're going to talk about today. Nicole Sauce was in town last week for some stuff I'll tell you about later this week, but we were talking about like where can you grow it, and we realized like you can grow them anywhere, and then we're like, well, where can't you? And our takeaway was, if you can't grow sweet potatoes where you live, move, because where you live is way too cold for people. You know, you're like up above the Arctic Circle or something if you cannot grow any variety of sweet potatoes. There's some that are incredibly fast, less than 90 days. There's just a ton of different options. So we can do it anywhere, but they're also, again, as I said, they're high calorie, and especially done with good quality organic practices, they're a nutrient-dense carbohydrate/calorie crop. And they're incredibly resilient. There are certain varieties like Murasaki, which we'll talk about toward the end, very drought tolerant. That doesn't mean you can plant them in the desert and not water them at all. I'm just saying that they really handle a bit of drought fairly well. And there's quite a few varieties that are fairly drought tolerant. In fact, you may find that you actually have to stress your sweet potatoes a little bit toward the end of the season with some lack of irrigation just to really trigger a very high yield of tuber set. That as long as they feel like things are just golden and just going to keep going, they tend to put more energy into making more and more vines than they do into making tubers. And there's just so many ways you can increase your production with sweet potatoes. One way is simply as your vines grow, you simply dig a hole and put your vine in and back out of that hole and then cover it up, and it'll root in that place and it'll set tubers when it's time to do tuber set. So you can actually plant a relatively small number in a bed and end up completely filling a bed with sweet potatoes. That's just one example of how productive they can be. Another way a friend of mine does this is they look like miniature versions of my composters. And honestly, he's composting with them while he's growing sweet potatoes. So it's just basically you take like some goat fencing, let's say 3-foot goat fence, and you make a ring out of it and you stand it up. And then you fill it with, you know, good starter soil, compost mix, what have you. And you put your sweet potato tubers or your slips into it. As they start growing, you keep adding material. And once they add enough length of the vine, you weave them through, back and forth through the tower that you're building, and then you pile on top of them. So now they're going to make potatoes all the way to the top of that tower. And my friend that does this, he starts out with a good soil mix, but then when he starts adding, he's like me, he does a lot with ponds. So he has plants like water hyacinth and water lettuce and stuff like that. He just pulls those out of his ponds as he gets those that weaving done and just covers it with that and then keeps adding it. And that stuff breaks down really, really fast. So by the end of that season, he's got a whole tower full of sweet potatoes and a whole tower full of compost. And it's your function stacking. That's something that I really don't know another plant that will do that for you. And then every time, if you got the water plants available because you've done some of my aquatic stuff, every time you add those plants, you're actually, because they're so full of water, as they release that water, you're watering the tower at the same time you're adding material to it. So there's just a lot you can do with them. They're incredibly easy to propagate, and we'll talk about how, but there's probably not a thing that you can go like to the store and buy one organic sweet potato and turn around and make 100 plants from or more. You probably, if you pushed, you could make about 500 plants per potato fairly easily and consistently. There's just not a lot of things you can do that with, you know, other than sweet potato, as far as I know anyway. They are dual purpose because not only are they good food for us, they're also good food for livestock. So one of the main uses we get out of sweet potato around here is they grow so much top growth that we just keep cutting back that top growth and we feed our ducks the sweet potato. The ducks like it, the chickens like it, and the geese like it, but the ducks go nuts over it. You know, I've taken a wheelbarrow full of sweet potato vine to my ducks, and you come back in a couple hours and all that's left is the vine itself. All the leaves are stripped gone. And we just pick the vines up and throw them in the compost. So they're a livestock feed. But you can feed tubers to cattle. You can feed tubers to hogs. Both of those will eat them as well. And we actually use sweet potato in when we make our own dog food. And we do that with very low-cost chicken, and we will dice up sweet potato and steam that and incorporate that into the dog's food as a way to stretch the dog's food, giving them some variety and some fiber and things like that as well. So they have a tremendous amount of duality in what they can do for you. And they're just, as I said during the intro, really adaptable to climate. I'm here in Texas. I can grow sweet potato. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, I could grow regular, you know, Irish potatoes or what have you, Peruvian potatoes. No problem with blight, nothing. I mean, there was a great time of year to do it in the spring. You kind of got that production in for the year and what have you. My uncle grew potatoes. You know what? They can grow sweet potatoes up there. I can't grow potatoes for shit down here, regular potatoes, but I can grow sweet potatoes. Those are very different climates. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, if we went about 2 weeks in the summer without rain, people started using the word drought. If you go 2 weeks in between rains and our main summer down here, people start looking around like, what? Like we've had 1 year like that in the past 20, and people started using the word flood, right? There's no flood, but they just thought they were going to have floods because it's ridiculous for us to have rain like every 14 days for our summer. Where, again, up where I grew up, if you didn't get it every 14 days, you really started to worry. Like a regular rain shower a week at least was typical. And so we can grow in those different climates. But I have friends in South Florida that grow sweet potatoes. I have friends in California that grow sweet potatoes. I have friends in Washington State that grow sweet potatoes. I don't know how much more disparaging on climate type you can get than that. And sweet potatoes are just a fantastic plant because of that. And then we have how we can grow and expand our crops. Like, okay, if you're going to do this, what is kind of the process? The biggest thing with the sweet potato is that we can produce something called slips. And a slip is simply called that because we slip it off the tuber. And there's a lot of ways to do it. But one is that we take, this is kind of the high school kid, grade school kid way to do it. You put some, you know, toothpicks in it or something, and you take a glass of water or a jar, and then you stick it in there kind of like the avocado trick. And so the bottom of the sweet potato is in the water, and the top of the potato is out of the water. And, you know, within a week or so, it'll start to make little sprouts. And as those sprouts come up, once they get long enough, you take your hand and just break them off where they connect to the tuber. They go into another glass of water, and they root out. And that works, and many people have done it. What I started doing a few years ago And I just found that it worked better and got more slips out of one potato. Is instead of this rigmarole and going vertical and half in and half out of the water, you just take a shallow dish and you put a couple inches of water in it. You lay the potato on its side and you do the same thing. But now that you've got more surface area of the potato, more place for slips to come up. And that worked too. What I've discovered this year, and I'm probably never doing it another way ever again, is propagating in soil, actually a potting mix. And the way that I've been doing this, and man, this works fantastic. You get like a big bowl or a bucket or something, fill up with water and throw the potato in it for 24 hours. Let it soak and hydrate itself really heavily. Then take that potato and bury it in a pot or a pan or anything that you can put soil in and just barely cover it. And it'll go crazy. And what seems to actually make it sprout even better is leave just a little bit of the top of it exposed. And it'll grow like crazy. The other thing you can do is bury it a little bit deep in a container. This will take longer. But here's the cool thing about that. As your slips come up out of the ground, now that slip, you know, I mean, let's say it has 3 inches in the ground. And we're talking about potting soil, something really light. So you reach down into your container and slip it off the potato and pull it out. It's already rooted. But I've been going with the more shallow method for this because I don't mind rooting them. I have plenty of ways to do that. Now, my number one way that I root slips is I don't do it in a jar, in a window, or on behind the sink or whatever. I take them outside and I have these things I call air stacks in my ponds. And basically, that's just where the water returns. There's a bigger piece of pipe. And that way the water can bubble, the oxygen happens, but it doesn't mess up surface vegetation is the main reason I do it. And just sticking them in there, man, they root like 2-3 days. They have crazy roots on them. Not everybody's going to have that. So just in a jar or a glass, in a windowsill until they're well rooted. And then when you plant them, when you've rooted a slip, usually you're not going to plant them until it's pretty warm out. So providing them some shade until they adjust from the shock, and then once they're off to the races, you pretty much can't stop them. Now, my number one thing to provide shade for a plant you're kind of like dealing with transplant shock with, you can find them at Home Depot and Lowe's. All the aquatic stores sell them. They are a 4-inch square pot that has a bunch of holes in it that are designed to take like an aquatic plant. You put soil in it. You put the plant in it. It sits in the water. You turn that thing upside down, and I mean peppers, tomatoes, et cetera. I use them all the time. But just a day or two, you know, and then like last couple hours of sunlight, go out and take them off and do that for like 2 more days and then just let them go and they'll be fine. That's just a little extra thing added in there. One of the big things, though, is I'm going to give you a bunch of varieties in a minute. But understand that different varieties do well in different climates. Some are more drought tolerant. When you look at some are faster to produce. So even though you think of Georgia as deep in the South and maybe you're have a shorter growing season, Georgia Jet is like a 90 day from the time the slip goes in the ground so you can pull tubers out. It's only 90 days. So that one may work better for you. Some do really well in very moist climates. Some do really well in really kind of drier climates. So as you decide you want to start trying some varieties, just do a little bit of research about the varieties that are best suited for where you are, along with the attributes that you want most. And there's some really cool attributes that we're going to talk about today, too. And then you want to make sure that you have a way to store and preserve them long term. And we're going to talk about that more today. But the basic way is to make sure that they're dried well after they're harvested, that there's no nicks and dents and things on them. And then they're kept in a, you know, 70-ish percentile humidity, cool and dark. So you want them in the dark. They're less likely to start sprouting on you. And the other thing you can do is as you store your sweet potatoes, as you're going to draw from them, kind of look through them. And ones that are getting maybe a little, like they're still good, but they're starting to feel like a little soft in a spot, or they seem like maybe there's a little bad spot on them you can cut off, use those first. And then always remember that biochar extends storage life. So if you're making biochar and you're storing like baskets or trays of produce in your pantry or root cellar or whatever, put down a layer of biochar. Remember, it's not gone either. right? It's not like you've only used it for that. Use that for one storage season, and then that biochar goes into whatever you do with it in your system. If you put it in your chicken coop, put it in your chicken coop. If you go right into your compost, go right in your compost. Whatever it is you do with your char after that season of storage, what's happening is that biochar is very hungry. It's absorptive, adsorb, not absorb, adsorb. And as it's you're having these volatiles released from food that you're storing, like ethylene gases, that biochar will grab onto it. And by reducing the exposure to ethylene and other off gases from plants, it extends their storage life. Often it can extend storage life by as much as 50%. So something that would have made it 3 months will now make it 4.5 to 5 months. That's a big gain. And for most of us, that bridges the gap into the next production cycle. There's some other ways to store we'll talk about later, including making flours and chips and stuff like that. It's just a very versatile crop. When you are curing for shelf stability, root cellaring is probably the best way to go. I have a neighbor, they don't really grow anything in their garden anymore, but the one thing they did grow was sweet potatoes. And they have a tornado shelter, and they really did nothing except throw them in boxes and put them down in their tornado shelter. And I used to get free slips from him because by the time they would pull them back out in the spring, that was pretty much what they were good for, because they were all starting to send sprouts off, even being kept down in there for that long. But they were completely healthy tubers at that point. And these were people, like, you know, their doctor told them that they needed to eat better. So they put in a garden that their son tended for them, and then they ate none of the food that came out of it. So they didn't even get the exercise or the food. They're just weirdos. But it did show me how well they'll store if you store them in something like a root cellar, because their tornado shelter pretty much is a root cellar. They are excellent to dehydrate for flour for extended use. And I will tell you toward the end, I actually have a way for a printout for you guys that you can download and print out or just save on your device that will tell you how to make flour out of them. And again, biochar will extend the storage life of just about any food. So they're very storable, specifically for the length of the average winter when you're not really getting a lot of production from other things, and you need to rely on that stored food. Let's talk about some alternative uses here, like, again, sweet potato flour. Again, I have a downloadable for you on this. It will be in the audio notes. And if you look down in the video notes right now, there's a link. If you click it now, it won't go anywhere if we're still live, and we are live as I speak anyway. But if the live's going on, it's not up yet. But it'll be up about 30 minutes after we're done. And there's a PDF you can download toward the bottom of the show notes today, and it will tell you exactly how to make flour. But it's basically you dehydrate sweet potatoes. You cut it into thin strips, and you can either use an actual, like an Excalibur dehydrator, or you can do it in your oven at a low temperature. And you dehydrate them until they're crispy, and then you grind them into a flour. And that flour can be used to make bread. It can be used to make pancakes. It can be used as a standalone flour, though that's not, for most things, the best way to use it, because it doesn't have any gluten. It won't form any kind of a bread-like consistency for you. But it was very historically used, as were regular potatoes, to actually extend flour, because flour didn't used to be super cheap. It's only modern production methods and subsidies that have made growing wheat so inexpensive that we feed grain to animals. That's something humans never did 200 years ago, was feed grain to animals. Maybe a little bit of bad grain or something, but it was a very important staple for humans, and it was reserved for humans. So there were some shortages where people would have to rely more on other grains like barley's and rye in their breads, but there were also a lot of shortages where potatoes were something that the average person can grow. And this is something I think we don't really appreciate enough. Growing grain in quantity is something you really have to want to do and have the space to do it in significant amounts. So if you were a poor, lower middle class person a couple hundred years ago in early America, and you had a small little plot of land, you probably weren't going to grow wheat or barley or something like that. Maybe a little bit of corn or something, maybe. but you would generally rely on larger producers and purchase it the way that we do today, and you'd grow vegetables. But one of the things that people could grow were potatoes and sweet potatoes, so they got used a lot in flours. And once they're a flour, you can do anything else that you would do with a flour with them, including where we're going to go next, though it's not how I would recommend you do it, which is for beer, brewing and fermentation. Unless you just only have flour, you can use a mash for that. And when I say mash, I mean mashed sweet potato. And I have a download for you today, too, on how to use sweet potato for distillation or for making beers. And again, that could be cut with other grains or other adjuncts, but there's a lot of carbohydrate in sweet potato. There's a lot of sugar in sweet potato. And if you're going to make an alcohol, you need sugar for the yeast to consume. The yeast consume it, and they poop out alcohol and CO2. So you can literally make some pretty damn good moonshine with sweet potato. Really good moonshine with sweet potato. I've had some good sweet potato moonshine. It was literally made with nothing but sweet potato, and there has to be some enzymic action and things like that in the mash to convert all the starches to simple sugars so the yeast can break them down into alcohol. But it's actually one of the easiest all-mash moonshines or all-mash beers that you can make. And historically, it was very much used as a product to make beers. And it actually makes a pretty decent beer. Next up today is animal feed, like we had talked about otherwise. The leaves and vines are great to feed livestock. But again, the tubers also cattle, hogs, and things like that. And you can do a hell of a lot worse than, you know, growing a huge bed of sweet potatoes if you're growing hogs. And then finishing the hogs on the sweet potatoes, like the last 2 or 3 weeks, just feed them as much as they can get their mouth on, right? And like you could literally make an area that is designed that you just move them in there to finish and let them dig them up and eat them themselves. And you have perfectly prepared ground for your next crop. And I wouldn't do sweet potatoes there, by the way, next year. I would do them I would rotate kind of like the Victory Chicken Garden. I would have the pigs root this up. I would plant a completely different crop as a form of crop rotation. And then the next season, do your sweet potatoes over here, bring your hogs in to finish them. If you don't have the ability to move the animals in, of course, you can harvest yourself. One thing to be careful with harvesting sweet potatoes is kind of going in the ground softly, kind of figuring out where your vines are, coming in with a fork and trying to come in from below. Because if you stab them, which will happen, you'll have a few that happens to, use those ones right away because they're just not going to store very well for you. They also are, you know, one of the things I always teach on homesteading is it's not just about what you can do for yourself directly. In other words, if I grow a sweet potato, I can eat a sweet potato, right? If I make a sweet potato chip, I can eat a sweet potato chip. If I make sweet potato moonshine, I can drink sweet potato moonshine. Can you monetize some things? Even in small amounts, you don't have to have a side hustle even that like pays your mortgage for a side hustle to matter. If you can cover like all the costs of your seeds and your fertility adjuncts and things like that, maybe your pots and stuff like that for starting your plants every year just from what you can sell off, well, now the food's free. Now you've gone from reducing the cost of food to making the food free other than your labor. And sweet potatoes open up a tremendous ability to do that. One, you can probably grow more than you'll need. And if you grow some of the kind of harder to find ones that people don't know, it may make a really good like farmer's market product or something like that. And one of the things I found for a lot of people is the good producer ain't necessarily good at farmer's market, and the farmer's market guy ain't necessarily the great producer. And while a lot of farmers markets say the food has to be grown here, it doesn't necessarily mean you had to grow it here. Somebody did. So this is a great product to partner up with somebody who's already doing farmers markets that would like to expand their offering and do something kind of like a revenue share split on those tubers, especially if you grow some stuff like, you know, Hawaiian purple or like O. Henry or Nancy Hall that are like a white sweet potato that people have never seen. Some of these sweet potatoes have this gorgeous white skin and bright purple interior, and you take somebody that's at a farmer's market, and this is what I've always said about farmer's markets. When I go to a farmer's market, like we used to, when we lived in Hot Springs, we went almost every week through the season that it was open. And the problem always was Peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers. Like, it's just everywhere. And we would always go up to any booth when we looked and saw something we didn't know about. We didn't always buy it, but like, even if we knew what it was, if it just nobody else had it, like, I want to go see this and talk to the guy about why they're producing, how they're doing it, and what have you. And so if you have a white skin, bright purple sweet potato cut in half, set there where people can see that color profile, people that go to farmers markets, they're looking for that wow thing to put on their table. And that would be a wow thing if you took, and some of the purple varieties like that really hold their color even when they're cooked. So if you were to dice that up, leave it skin on, and roast that, that would be a fantastic white skin, purple potato, roasted, maybe with a little honey drizzled on it or something like that. That's what's going to sell, is something that's different. So you have the ability to sell the tubers, which is your main product, but you know what else people buy? Slips. I sell the Okinawan purple, which are really, when we get to the Murasaki, are not from Okinawa. They're not from Japan. Okay. They're actually from Louisiana. But I sell the slips for those, and I will sell about $100 worth a year. That's all I'll sell. I make them in bundles of 10. I sell them 10 for $10 on Nextdoor, and I sell 10 bundles, and that's it. And that way I sell them all like in a couple days and they're gone. And then I have to deal with a bunch of bullshit about, well, can I get half or whatever? I have 10 bundles of 10 for $10 a bundle. How many do you want? Let me know. Limit two per customer. Nobody buys two, but because I say limit two, they sell faster, right? So a little bit of marketing advice goes there as well. But if you were to come up with four or five sweet potatoes you grew every year that are all unique, you can't go down to Albertsons or Kroger and buy. You can put together like four, 16 slips, $20. I guarantee you can sell, again, 10, 20 bundles a year. You put 100, 200, 300 bucks in your pocket. You use that to fund your other production. You want to go bigger than that? Go for it. Go for it. Art by Lee Murphy says, and I have this one on my list of varieties, by the way. Stokes Purple is an electric violet inside and out, but they need a lot of room. Most of these need quite a bit of room. Georgia Jet, again, is one that you really don't need a ton of room for. It's kind of an ideal sweet potato grown containers, but these things do sprawl. But one thing I've learned about sweet potato is if you prune back the vines in a very heavy sprawling variety, they tend to set lots of tubers for you, and you can control that growth and then use that growth again. It's a great compostable. It's a green. It's also a great feedstock. Again, ducks, chickens eat the crap out of it. So it's just some other ideas there. But you can make a good amount of quick and easy money selling slips. And if you decide after listening to this show, well, I'm not going to go find an organic potato and make my own slips, I'm going to just buy some slips, where do you see what it costs you to buy 20 slips? From a lot of, you know, from good providers out there, you're not going to buy much for less than about $14 plus planned shipping. And plus when you buy, and I've done it, so don't not do it because I'm saying this, but when you buy slips in the mail, they're never quite the quality of when you make them your own or get them from a friend or make them for, you know, a friend or what have you, because you have to ship them and they don't really enjoy the process of being shipped. When I've bought slips through the mail, what I had to do was to then, when they came in, kind of rehab them. And so I'd break them, like if I bought 25, break them into like two stacks of 12 because one of them was dead, put them in some jars, and then I'd put them in my garage because it was cooler in there than outside, and they got filtered light into the garage because we have skylights. And I would do that, and it would take about a week or two before I'd be comfortable planting them out. Where when you make your own slips, once they're rooted, you can plant them out if the weather is right for doing it. That's also something, you know, as far as selling them. Yeah, maybe you can buy them for a little bit less money from Burpees or somebody like that, but they're not going to be healthy and active and alive and happy. They're going to need some rehab, where if you get mine, you just put them in the ground the same day, give them some shade until they heal in, but they're just an easy, simple plant to grow. And I see your comment there, Linda. Email me, but probably not, but maybe. We'll see. Anyway, Linda on Facebook. Just leave it at that. All right. Next is, you could actually make some money off some of the, let's say, value-added product. And I would tell some of you guys that have the Harvest-Rite freeze dryers, freeze-dried sweet potato chip might be a really interesting product. I've never had one freeze-dried. I'm going to tell you how to make chips in a bit. But freeze-dried might be a freeze-dried sweet potato strip chip might be really damn good. It also seems like a good way to make flours. So like a sweet potato flour, especially off of a unique variety, might be a great little niche product or even a next step up of value add. For instance, I knew a gal here locally. She was a longtime listener of my show. She ended up taking over the Arlington Farmers Market, and they have certain rules about most being produced locally and stuff like that. But value added product like a tortilla or something, there just had to be at least two ingredients in the item that were grown locally. So she was doing things like she was growing amaranth and including amaranth grain in her tortillas or flatbreads, depending on how you would look at them, so that there would be a local ingredient in it, even if she was buying organic flour for the base of the tortilla. So you could see how something like a sweet potato flour might be used to produce a higher order item that could be sold as a value-added cottage industry product as well. So it opens up a lot of opportunity, you know, even fermented goods that can come off of these things. And that's kind of gray market, so I'll leave it there for you. Though I've never experimented with lacto-fermentation of sweet potato. I don't know that I'd like it, but who knows? Maybe there's something to that. And then, you know, they just have trade value because they're a semi-durable product. And what I mean by that is like a non-durable product is a tomato unless you can it or dry it or something. When you take a tomato and pull that off of the vine, you've got a week about of storage before it starts to go bad. And in 2 weeks, it's mush. Where when you take a sweet potato, it doesn't store quite as well as like an onion or a garlic would, but it stores very well, especially if you have a nice root cellar or something like that to keep your product in. So now you have a product that if we end up on hard times has barter value that also has storage capacity and and it's kind of divisible, right? Because you have this huge sack of sweet potatoes and your neighbor doesn't want the whole sack, but maybe they want four or six or eight, easy enough to break down into smaller units that way. Next is just, I want to talk to you about some unique and interesting varieties here, because I think that there is probably more sweet potato varieties than we could cover in an hour if all we did was cover sweet potato varieties. So I just have a relatively short list of like six varieties that a lot of people are not very familiar with. And I also have some pictures for you that I'm going to pull up if you're on the video instead of the audio. And in the show notes, there's a link to all the pages that I'm about to put up on the screen. But this is what I want to say. When I put this episode together today, I did not spend a huge amount of time like putting together a PowerPoint deck or something like that, or deeply researching suppliers of either the tubers themselves as an organic vegetable or as slips or what have you. All I did when I put these searches into Google Images was go, that picture shows it well, and then I'm just linked to the page that had that picture on it. So I'm not endorsing, like some of these places actually sell slips. They probably are fine, but I'm not going to guarantee you that they are. Some of them might actually sell like an organic tuber, and because it's for food, but you could propagate it. I'm not endorsing them. I'm not saying bad or good. I'm just saying this was a place I could get you a picture and show you what I was talking about. So let's start off and talk about these Murasakis. Now, again, these were developed in the Louisiana State University Ag Program. They are not actually from Okinawa, and they're often marketed as an Okinawan sweet potato, which is a totally different thing. They're also often marketed as like a Japanese red, which is what they're from. So these were done with some selective breeding by LSU, which has LSU has produced some of the most amazing open market, you know, kind of heirloom, anybody can grow it, propagate it, stuff that there is. The LSU fig is a perfect example. It's excellent fig, LSU purple, just amazing fig tree. And, you know, you're free to propagate your ass off with it. You're not going to get sued by Monsanto or something. Another one is the LSU nutty groundnut. And groundnut Apis americana is a tuber that grows along like creek banks and things like that from Virginia up into New England as its primary native range. And they did this work to increase the size with selective breeding, not GMO selective breeding. And they made these ground nuts that are, you know, they get as big as your fist, like a small potato, which is very uncommon. I have those from LSU in addition to the figs. This is another product that I didn't even learn until last year that this was not from Japan or from Okinawa or whatever, because it's always marketed that way because it sounds cool. This actually comes from a sweet potato that is commonly known as Japanese red. There's not a tremendous amount of difference between the two. There's also one called Korean purple that looks a lot like this. But Korean purple, I am told, has more of a chestnut-like flavor or texture to it than these do. All of them, though, are fantastic. And this is my go-to sweet potato. I grow the crap out of these. They're a purplish-red skin, but they're like a butter cream-colored, like a white to yellow flesh. They are nowhere near as sweet as your typical orange potatoes with like a Bogart or something like that, or a Garnet. They are somewhere between a Irish lumper potato and a sweet potato. They're like halfway in between the two of them. They taste when you, like if you do a roast on these, they taste like you put butter on them, even when all you put on them was salt. They have like a butter-like complexity to them. They're extremely thin-skinned. Unless you have a reason, there is no reason to skin them. If you scrub them too hard, the skin will come off. So these are ones that when you are knocking the dirt off them and all and rinsing the dirt off them, be careful with. Because they store well, but they don't store well if that skin's removed. And I'm telling you, like, just trying to, like, you can sometimes, like, use a brush on potatoes that have a lot of dirt on them or something to get some of the dirt off. It will take the skin off them. It is paper thin. The other way these things are beautiful and delicious is fried. And if you want to make the best fry you'll ever make, and I don't know if I'd call it a sweet potato fry because it won't taste like a sweet potato fry. And I don't know if I'd call it a French fry because it won't taste like a French fry. It tastes like something in the middle, and it tastes like a crispy coated pillow is what I can describe it. It's just so soft in the middle. And the way to do it is cut your fries whatever size shape you want them, twice fry. Fry them in something like tallow, by the way. Fry them until they will be edible. They're fully cooked, but they're going to be kind of soggy sad, like just like sweet potato fries always are, just a little bit limp. And Adrian says that my voice is breaking off. Hopefully that will stop because there's nothing I can do about it. But they will be kind of like limp. Drain them on paper towel. Let them cool down to about room temperature. Throw them back in the oil or the tallow, what have you, or the lard, and fry them a second time. And they get this amazing crunchy crisp outside, and they're like a pillow on the inside. I am not a big mayonnaise on potatoes person, but if you mix about 1/3 gochujang, which is a fermented Korean chili paste, with about 2/3 mayo and make a dipping sauce for that, you just won't believe how good it is, right? Is anybody else having trouble with my voice, or is it unique to Adrian? I would hope that the answer is it's unique to Adrian. Moving on. Now we're going to talk about an actual Okinawan sweet potato. This is variety comes out of Okinawa, but has been also marketed as Hawaiian purple. This is a true purple sweet potato in that the flesh is deep purple, but the skins, let me get that one brought up for you. There's a make it a little easier to explain. The skins are like a light colored, you know, somewhere between like a tan and a white. And this gorgeous kind of veined with a little bit of white in it, deep purple interior. Again, this is something that if you are already growing things that you're selling into the restaurant space, looks like whatever caused the choppy voice is gone. Anyway, if you're selling into the restaurant space, this is a product that a chef is going to look at and be like, wow, I can do something with that. I can do something with that. And can you buy this potato? Yeah. But your chefs that want to market local food, you're probably not going to find a lot of locals competing with you. But this is a really easy, easy sweet potato to grow. It's very high in antioxidants. Usually things that have a purple color to them are. And it is really commonly used in Asian cooking and Hawaiian cooking. So this is a great one to consider as well. This is the one, this next one that Lee Murphy mentioned. It's a very similar in appearance, but the skin is more of a light purple, pinkish skin, deep purple color on the potato itself, Stokes purple. And this is another one of those potatoes that if you're looking to market an end product, it's probably one of the best ones that you can grow. And so I really recommend that you check that out. Again, Stokes purple. It's another very hearty sweet potato, but as Lee said in the comments, it does sprawl, I mean, even for sweet potatoes, a lot. But again, you can control it by aggressive pruning back. Next, we're going to just say white sweet potatoes. These are sweet potatoes that have white flesh and a tan to white skin. Probably the best known variety that's grown in North America anyway is called O. Henry. And almost all white flesh sweet potatoes kind of go in league with Murasaki that they have a less sweet flavor than orange varieties. And they also make really great flours, and they're really great brewing. So if you're looking for a sweet potato that is a good brewing sweet potato, either make beer or moonshine with, it is this. They're also fantastic for those that like to do a sweet potato bread. And again, I really recommend if you look at using potato of any kind to make bread, you're more on take your flour, your normal wheat flour ration, cut that in half and replace half of it with potatoes. And while this was always considered in our kind of colonial and post-colonial past to be a mark of somewhat being poor, and it wasn't always done with flours either. You can also make a steamed or boiled potato mash and mix that into with your flour and yeast and all into a bread. The resulting product is not inferior. I think it was one of those things that people viewed it as being more of a poverty thing because the rich person who didn't grow a garden for themselves just bought everything would never do it. But the actual resulting product, in fact, a lot of bakeries and stuff like that are really proud of the fact that they sell potato rolls today. It's the same theory. It gives it a light kind of unique texture and flavor. But these guys are really good for that. And even though I'm like just kind of generically saying white sweet potato, here's a few varieties of white sweet potato to look for. O. Henry, Bonito, and Nancy Hall. Next, I've got one more purple variety for you guys today. And this one is called Molokai. And this is another like light purple skin, very deep purple interior, little bit different look of the white flecking in the center of it. And it is very nutrient dense. And it is something that's great for health conscious eaters, but it's even better to sell to health conscious eaters. When I say it's great for health conscious eaters, what's the difference between it and a Stokes Purple or a Murasaki or an Okinawan? Not much, but it's been heavily marketed to that market. So if you live somewhere that is kind of one of the key demographics that you would be selling to, fantastic product for doing just that. And again, none of these are really common at your local stores or what have you. So you have that advantage. The last one, and despite the name, it has absolutely nothing to do with the plant we call ginseng, but the plant itself is called ginseng red sweet potato. These are red skinned with a very white flesh. This is another white flesh variety, but just a brilliant red color skin. Also thin, kind of like Murasaki. It's not as sweet. It's even a little bit less sweet than the Murasaki potato. And it has a very nutty-like flavor to it. I have never grown this one. I have eaten it. I'm going to definitely grow some of these this year. I'm probably going to end up growing like three or four different varieties of sweet potato this year. So it's, again, I hope like I'm kind of driving home the idea here that this simple plant that is not something people tend to eat a lot of in America anyway, is actually a staple around the world. There's a reason there's so much of a play on like Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Okinawan, and that's because that part of the world is where these things come from. The native varieties that were selectively bred, some of the ones that we have, they're actually just native plants that people have cultivated a long time. Some they've actually worked on making them better and done some crossbreeding. Because sweet potatoes, if you are in a long enough climate for them to do so, will flower and they will produce a true seed. So that's how a lot of the breeding development was done. Can you do that? Sure. It's beyond me. I don't have, like, I would have to take heroic measures to grow a sweet potato in my climate long enough for it to flower and pollinate, let alone cross-pollinate. That would be manual. And the reason almost nobody does it is because of how easy it is to propagate them. So let's talk a little bit here about, well, how do you get started? Where do you get your initial sweet potatoes from? If you go to a grocery store, buy a sweet potato and try to make slips with it, it's about a 50-50 shot that it will or will not produce for you if you buy a conventionally grown sweet potato. If it's not organic, it's probably had some level of a sprout inhibitor applied to it, some form of chemical. And it's not necessarily bad for you, but it is bad for making potato slips. It's designed to do exactly what it says. When you leave a sweet potato in the light long enough, even fairly dry air, it will tend to want to start to form vines and grow. So to extend storage life, most sweet potatoes, once they're harvested, are treated with a chemical to discourage sprouting. It doesn't mean it won't. I've heard people, it'll never do it. If you put two in a bucket, one of them probably will. But with 50-50 odds, you could pick two and easily pick two that won't. And that leads to that. If you get an organic one, that shit's not supposed to be on there. Nobody said should. Should not be on there. If it is, that means it's not really organic. But that happens all the time, especially on imported products. And a lot of these sweet potatoes may be coming in from China. Right? There's a huge amount of product shipped over. And if you're putting them in a shipping container and they're going to go across the ocean, you put the sprout inhibitor on there. But in general, one of the best ways to find some of these cool varieties, go to a grocery that is like big on having organic produce and big on variety. So a Central Market, a Whole Foods, et cetera. And just look for the variety that you want to try, or find a variety that I didn't mention that you maybe never heard of. But when you look at it and you read the description about the flesh color, because all you can see is the outside, I want to grow this. As long as it's organic, you should be able to produce slips from it. And again, the method of soaking the potato in water overnight to fully hydrate it and then planting it in the soil, that has worked better and faster and more productively for me than anything I've ever done. I mean, it's a huge upgrade. The aluminum throwaway pans, you know, that you put in the oven to reheat things in and stuff like that, the ones that are not a half or a whole, they're kind of a little bit bigger than a half, usually you can fit three tubers in there, and there's no reason that they can't be different because you can look at them and see what they are. And one of those can probably make you 300 from three different varieties. So you got 101, 100, 200 or the other, right? And it's so simple. You fill them up, you put the potatoes in the dirt, leave a little bit of the potato to stick out, and start pulling slips as they come up. And the more you pull, the more the tuber will produce. If you just let it keep going, eventually it's like, oh, I'm good. I've got some growth going on. When you start pulling those vines off, then that tuber's innate intelligence, you know, and they don't think the way I'm about to describe. It's just the only way we can put words on it as humans are like, uh-oh, I need to reproduce. I lost my vine. I better produce another one. I better produce another one. I better produce another one. And they are, again, super easy to propagate that way. So I encourage you to do it. And then, you know, if you start doing it, you could really start to then play around with some of these storage methods and some of these alternative uses. Again, I have three PDFs for you in the show notes. They're just simple text PDFs to tell you how step-by-step. So I don't have to sit here and explain it on the air and bore you. But sweet potato chips. And I've got two different ways for you to make sweet potato chips today. One is a long-term storage chip, something that's going to last a year, especially if you were to put it like in a jar and dry can it. That uses a dehydrator, and it's done slow over a bit longer of a period of time until they're crispy. And those, and I've made those, if if you take them out and they're a little bit not so crisp anymore, you just throw them in the oven for 5 minutes at like 300 degrees and re-dry them out. And they're just great to eat out of hand as a chip. And then the other method, you can do it in an oven. And when you do it in an oven, it's more of a fresh chip. Of course, you can make sweet potato chips by just throwing them on a mandolin and deep frying them, but they can also be a little bit more storable and less like a French fry done with a low temperature oven, about 250 degrees or 225, I don't remember. But again, it's in the slip. I also have, or in the PDF, I also have a download for you guys again on making sweet potato flour. And you can make sweet potato flour out of a white sweet potato because, well, it's cool. It's white. It looks like flour. But you could do it out of a purple or a red or something as well, which might be a really interesting thing for a value-added product or an interesting item in, let's say, a restaurant. Take a really bright red or orange flesh, like a Beauregard or a garnet or something like that. Make a sweet potato flour out of that. Have a chef do a sweet potato pancake with it. That maybe is only one-third sweet potato, but it's enough to give it that color. Again, people like different. People like unique, especially when they go out to eat. So I encourage you guys that are selling to restaurants, start thinking about how you take a low, because that's the thing about sweet potato, right? It's a low-cost product. But if you have a premium low-cost product, you have a mid- to higher-priced product, especially, and this is really important for those of you working with restaurants. You want to work with a restaurant that doesn't just say farm-to-table, but says eat locally and seasonally, because they're going to be the person that will work with a small producer that you can sell them, you know, a half a ton of sweet potatoes. I mean, that's not as hard to grow as you think it is, but a restaurant will go through that in a couple weeks. And so most small producers, you're not going to be able to keep up with that on a regular basis. But if you can do that and it's something that they have for a few weeks or a month, a year, now you've got something and they're willing to pay more for it because it's that unique item that comes and goes and disappears. So that's another way to look at it. And then, again, the beer and distillation with sweet potatoes. You know, everybody knows, I think, that one of the primary ways that vodka is made in Russia is with potatoes. So you can do the same thing with sweet potato. And I wonder just how much vodka is made in Russia, moonshine's made in Russia using sweet potato. Because in Russia, where people aren't free, they go ahead and make moonshine whatever they want. Nobody bothers them. Right. It's freedom is relative to what you want to do, I think. And so I really recommend that you experiment with these different alternative methods other than just taking a sweet potato, cooking it till it's soft, mashing it up and throwing freaking marshmallows on it. Like something that sweet doesn't need marshmallows. But especially, again, some of these white flesh varieties, diced up, hit them with some oil and salt. Throw them in the oven and cook them till they just begin to caramelize on the edges and get a little bit of char on them. They're fantastic. If I'm going to eat a potato, I'm probably going to eat something like that before I eat a regular potato or even a traditional sweet potato, is those white fleshed or yellow fleshed varieties of them. And distillation, again, is something that more and more people are doing, even though technically, you ain't supposed to. And remember, Mile High Distilling makes really great moonshine stills, and they're an MSB sponsor. And I'm telling you right now, if you buy a full setup from them and you use our discount, your membership was just paid for. So if you've been thinking to get into the distillation world of things, which a lot of people are, then that is an avenue toward that. And sweet potatoes would be a good feedstock, whether it's 100% or an adjunct to stretch your mash out a little bit more. I really do think, though, that every homesteader should at least consider this as a crop. If we just go back through it a minute here, number one, we've got a calorie/carbohydrate crop, which is a big deal because, like, most of what I grow is not a calorie crop. I'm never going to grow enough peppers and then eat enough peppers to get a day's calories from sweet peppers or hot peppers, God forbid, on the hot peppers, right? Even tomatoes or eggplants, you know, and certainly greens, chards, spinaches, lettuces, et cetera. These are more adjunctive dietary crops for me, right? They add flavor, they add variety, they add texture, a little bit of fiber. some micronutrient and things like that. My primary calories come in the form of meat and eggs and a little bit of cheese. But if you want to actually be able to get a caloric yield out of your garden, you have to go into a different world. You have to go into the world of carbohydrates. I don't know of a plant anyway that's like 75% protein, and a home grower can grow enough of it to make significant dents in their meal budget out of at all, right? The only thing I can tell you that I know that'll do that for people is corn, sorghum. If you really put in the effort, you can grow certain grains that will do this, or rices that will do this. But again, these are difficult for the small producer, but at least it can be done. Potatoes, sweet potatoes. That's about it. I might be missing one or two. Throw them at me if I am, but there's not a lot of options that really produce a lot of calories. And I guess you can go into fruits then. And it's still limited, you know, but you can look at other tubers like carrot. It's still very, very light in total calories, but it's a tuber, and that's why there is some carbohydrate yield. Or beets. There's certain beets you can grow that make a pretty decent carbohydrate crop, but all of them have kind of a time limit in the time of year you can grow them, and some geographic limits as well to getting good results from. Beets are a fall or a very early spring crop here. They do not like our summers at all. They will straight bolt, even though they're supposed to be a biannual. Sweet potatoes will grow here. They will grow in Pennsylvania. They will grow in Canada. They will grow in Florida. They will grow in Mexico. You know, they'll grow in the tropics of Panama and Costa Rica. So what other crop is there that has this sort of carbohydrate yield, this level of ease of propagation, reasonable longevity and storage that everybody and anybody can grow? And R. by Lee Murphy says, holeless oats might work, but they're still a pain to process. That's the other side. What is the processing of a sweet potato? Wash it off, cook it, and eat it. Cooking's optional, by the way. They can be eaten raw. I mean, if you look at almost every other crop that I talked about, you either have a processing bottleneck, because the sweet potatoes, pull it out of the ground, knock the dirt off it with a dry brush, let it dry out and cure, and put it into storage. That's it. What is the process for doing corn that way? Corn's one of the easier ones, too. I'm talking about a shell corn, not a sweet corn. Sweet corn starts to get less sweet 5 seconds after you pull it off the stalk. Best way to do sweet corn, pull it off the stalk and into the pot. If you can't do that, then blanch it and vacuum seal it and freeze it. It works pretty well, too, for a bit longer term storage. But if you want dry, long term storage without using energy, i.e. a freezer, then when we look at, like, the only other thing that will do, in my opinion, what a sweet potato will do and have a high caloric yield is a regular potato. And now we're back into dealing with blight, timing of when it will grow well, and other issues that sweet potatoes are largely immune to. I have never had a pest significantly impact sweet potato. I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm telling you it hasn't. And I think it's not that nothing will eat it, because, again, livestock love it. It grows so fast, it doesn't give a shit. In fact, I've done it with container growing, and I had the containers suspended off the ground inside my quail aviary, and then the vines had just trained them over to the side and let them dangle down, and it looked cool as shit, and the quail had a little forest to hide in, and that quail were constantly eating the piece they could reach, and they would eat it, and it would be, you know, 4 or 5 inches above their heads where they could stretch up and get it, and the next couple of days it'd be back down where they could get it again. And they would just go from one place to the next, self-feeding themselves. So if that didn't bother them, that's what I'm saying. If you need to get some insect pests that will eat some of their leaf matter and what have you, it takes a tremendous effort to really hurt them. And when they're a little bit stressed, all they do is make more of themselves. In other words, when they feel that maybe things are not quite optimum, they set more and larger tubers. So if something goes wrong, they have that carryover reproductive capacity. So why wouldn't a homesteader grow these? What would you replace it with? Does anybody have any ideas? What could you replace this as kind of the ultimate sovereignty thing? I would say that the closest we have is a grain. And for home growers, it's sorghum. And I've done a whole show on that a couple years ago. Because the one thing sorghum's got going for it is once you get that process, which is basically strip it off of the stalk, it'll store for years. All you got to do is keep it dry. It will store for years. You can store it in buckets, you know, and you can store it forever. But I'd much rather eat a sweet potato than eat sorghum. Sorghum, the processing to storage is very minimal. Sorghum, the process to eat, unless you're going to make like a porridge out of it, cooking it as like a whole grain berry, you know, you're making a flour or something like that with it. And of course, sorghum has a dual yield because you can get the sap and make sorghum syrup. But I don't really see that standing up against sweet potato. I've got a product that I can eat the way that it comes out of the ground. I can turn it into alcohol or I can turn it into a value added product like a flour or a chip. And it does all that for me. There's probably your best competitor. And it's also not much different, is it? Adventure Frog says squash and pumpkin. And I would say like a trunk, especially like your, I think C Mixta is the variety, like a Trumbuscino or a long neck pumpkin. I mean, these things store for ages. But they still don't quite have the yield in calories. So like your winter squash is like a butternut or something like that will help you out. Zach says home mushroom cultivation can supplement protein. Yeah, mushrooms have protein, but the, you know, how much protein you get from, let's say, the amount of mushrooms a person would eat compared to, you know, two bites of chicken. You know, and it definitely doesn't have the caloric yield. Now, I love me some mushrooms. We probably should do a show on home cultivation of mushrooms at some point because I think they are a fantastic additional thing. But I don't think they compete with a sweet potato from ease of growth, ease of propagation, and caloric yield from a in like a survival or subsistence gardening agriculture situation. That's why I brought this show to you today, because I really think the sweet potato is the, kind of the king of that. And the last thing, again, is think about experimenting with these different varieties. And I'll just throw this out here, right, as I'm going to surmise this. If I told you today, and I'm not saying this, so don't ask, because I feel like one sweet potato being propagated behind the thing, and that's for me. But if I had made some effort this winter, and I'd went out and got like ginseng red, Murasaki, Hawaiian purple, and Bonita white. And I had those five varieties. And I said, I am selling four of each, 20 slips in a bundle for $25 plus shipping. And I have 100 of them. By tomorrow morning, I would have to put up a post that said I'm out. I would have sold every one of them. There's probably a lot of you. I would have bought that. Okay. When you see something that you feel that way about, other people will feel that way about it too. Now, I'm not guaranteeing, you probably don't have a reach idea or whatever, so I'm not guaranteeing you can do that and sell it. What I am telling you can do is if you use tools like Facebook Marketplace, if you use tools, and the best one to me has been Nextdoor. Because, you know, Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist and all, you end up people contacting you. And those people, you know, especially where I live, like if you live in Chicago and somebody's looking at Chicago, it's probably pretty local. When you look at Fort Worth and Dallas are far enough apart, let alone like a Dallas suburb versus a Fort Worth suburb. You could be looking at an hour and a half drive. And most people aren't going to drive that far. And I don't want to ship or whatever. But when you look at Nextdoor, like 90% of the people that you interact with live within 10 minutes of your house. And when you do that, if you get a few people that want to buy it, it's very easy. Come by the house and I'll take care of you, right? And I'll tell you that this is the thing that we do all the time. We do it with duck eggs and we do it with other things that we sell here and there. I am not really that concerned that somebody rips me off over 10 bucks. I'm really not, for a bundle of sweet potato slips. So we'll put like a box in the shade and they're sitting in a plastic bag with a rubber band around them with wet paper towel. I'm not going to be home, but just right inside my gate, there'll be a box. Just take the sweet potato slips and leave the money. No one's ever stolen from us doing that. Some people haven't shown up, But everybody that's shown up that took the product left the money. And sometimes if they don't have exact change, like let's say we were doing something that was $8, they'll leave you a 10 and a little note, so don't worry about it. And so I have found that that kind of honor system is a great way to extend your sales reach without having to have deep, long conversations with people. Because sometimes it's not that I don't want to, but sometimes I'm not in the mood. I'm sure we've all had days like that, like, hey, can I look around and see everything? No, I don't want to do. And it's not that I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it now. I don't want to do it today. I'm tired. You know, I just put in a 12-hour day, and I want to go kick my feet up on my back porch and watch my ducks without you. And so in those situations, we'll just say we're not here, pull the car in the garage or something and leave it out there until it goes away and the money shows up. So that's a little extra there. But I really didn't get a bunch of questions today. I got some comments here and there. Here's an interesting comment, though. It says, my pigs won't eat russet potatoes. Will they eat sweet potatoes? Sorry if this was already answered. They will. Pigs will definitely eat sweet potatoes. And if you try a sweet potato raw and you try a white potato raw, you will quickly see why the pig will eat one and not the other. Sometimes a pig may not realize what something is, and breaking it open and so that they know what it is will often help them. I know people that raise turkeys, for instance, and they finish their turkeys on chufa, which is a little tuber that's, you know, it's about the size of a marble, maybe a little bit bigger than a common marble, not quite as big as the bigger marbles. And it grows on like a sedge grass. And every year they move their turkeys into this big plot full of chufa before they graduate them, throw some extra weight on them. And that's kind of a thing that they market. They have these pastured turkeys finished on chufa. And when you first bring the turkeys there, they really don't get it. And so what he'll do is he'll walk in with the turkeys and he'll pull a couple out and like tap them with his finger, because turkeys see your finger like a beak, right? And then they'll, you know, one turkey will kind of look at it and peck it. And, oh, wait a minute. And they eats it. And you pull a couple more out, and it doesn't take you're not the smartest animal in the world or anything, but they're pretty smart for a bird. And once they understand what's going on, they just go to town on it. Question from Jason, is there an animal that it can become toxic to? I don't think so. I've never heard of that. I can't guarantee it, but let's see what ChatGPT says. Let's just find out in real time. Any varieties, any animals likely to get toxicity issues from sweet potato? I doubt it. I'm going to tell you that I haven't seen an answer yet, but most animals don't eat things that give them problems unless they're somehow, sweet potatoes are generally safe for most animals, but there's a few considerations. Pigs love them raw and cooked. Goats, rabbits, leaves, and vines are great. Tubers should be limited because of too high a sugar content. Potential toxicity risks. Okay. Horses, large amounts of raw sweet potato can cause digestive upset. Moldy potatoes can cause harm to them. So a lot of animals that can eat a thing, if you feed them too much of it, it can become a problem. I can see it causing bloat. Cats, not toxic, but their digestive system is not designed for high starch intake. Cattle can eat vines and leaves, but too many sweet potato tubers can cause bloating. And that's another one of those things. Like, cattle can eat them. Absolutely. It's a quantity issue there. And moldy should not be fed to anything, basically. But overall, there's not much problem with them. It's about volume with certain animals, especially something that will pig out. It seems like pigs can pig out, but cows cannot pig out from them. So anyway, I think that's really hit all of the questions. Builder of Castles said, do we talk about yams? You know, yams are a very similar product. There's a whole new list of varieties there. I'm not going to talk about yams today, though. But I will tell you this. There's a lot of things sold in stores that are sweet potatoes that are called yams, but they're actually sweet potatoes. So it's about finding the variety to determine, is it actually a sweet potato or is it actually a yam? So sweet potatoes are part of the Ipomoea family. Ipomoea aquatica looks a lot like sweet potato vine, but the stalk is hollow, and until it gets really big, you can eat the stalk, not just the leaf. And that's a water plant known as Kang Kong. It's also known as like Korean or Chinese or Vietnamese or pick your Asian country, water spinach. And a sweet potato and Ipomoea aquatica look very, very similar. The flowers are very similar. And what the flowers really look like more than anything else, if you're familiar with an ornamental flower, different family, by the way, 4 o'clocks. They have a very, that 4 o'clocks are called that because supposedly they open at 4 o'clock every day. Do they really? No, but they open in the afternoon every day. And they have that kind of long, very delicate looking flower. And that's what sweet potato flowers, and that's what Ipomoea aquatica and anything else in that Ipomoea family will look about. Hey, Alabama says cats are obligate carnivores. I can't see why they shouldn't have sweet potatoes. I think they can, is what I just read there to you. It's a matter of quantity. That like a dog is probably going to be able to eat a significant quantity without any digestive problems, where a cat is going to be if they were fed too much of it. But a cat's probably not going to eat too much of it. And that's what I was going when I got the answer back in ChatGPT. Most animals are not going to eat things that are going to give them problems unless they're very foreign to them. So we've had issues with cattle eating way too many acorns and getting too much tannin. Cows can eat acorns. The problem is if you get a huge mass drop and they can get to them, they eat too many of them and they get tannic problems and they the tannic problems on the tannins, but they also can get toxicity and bloat from them as well. Another thing that we've seen cows eat that like I've seen cows eat them and I've seen no problems come from it. It's when they get their cow mouths on too many of them. Osage orange, they will just eat the crap out of them, but they're sticky and they will cause digestive problems for the cow if it eats too much. So here's my view on that, that will make it where this will never be an issue unless it's legitimately a total toxicity issue to something. I don't believe that anything should be fed anything exclusively. So for instance, right now I have baby ducks that are out in a duck tracker cages and they're eating a duck feed and they're getting grass through the bottom of the cages and they're getting mealworms. So they're getting a variety of greens. They're getting any insects dumb enough to go in there. They're getting a feed that's a good quality feed for them, and they're getting mealworms to vary their diets. When I didn't do that, and I just fed the baby ducks a really high quality feed one year, I had huge losses. I'm saying like 20% of a group of ducks that I raised that got a nutritional deficiency that I was able to, once I identified, I was able to correct it by adding yeast flakes, which are high in B12 to their feed. But as soon as I was like, okay, that's never happening again, and went to making sure that they had a variable diet that any creature in nature would, it all went away. Marjorie Wildcraft one time found out rabbits will eat Yaupon holly. So she started bringing bundles and bundles and bundles of Yaupon holly and wasn't feeding them anything else. And they started having heart attacks and dying. Why? Because Yaupon is the only North American source of native available caffeine. And she gave them caffeine overdoses. They got addicted. They ate like crazy and they little rabbit heart exploded, right? Gun related vids says, is there a good ROI for farming black soldier fly larva? There is. And you may be able to make some money with BSLs by selling them. But the real value in black soldier flies, even though that's not related to what we're talking about today, is livestock feed. And the best livestock feed systems I've seen using BSLs for like chickens or ducks, like the pods that they're grown in, they just climb out right to where the chickens and ducks eat. And once they know they're there, they'll check all the time and see if any are available, including if they start going into the ground, chickens will dig them up, or you can catch them and then feed them so you know that they're getting to the animals. So the fact that they can cut your feed bill and you're feeding something, it's pretty much protein and fat. That's all it is. It's extremely valuable to egg-laying birds, and it really improves their quality. The second is it's a waste elimination system where you can probably go to a few different like local restaurants or something and get more throwaway food than you know what to do with. And unlike something you would be just typically composting, it doesn't matter what's in there. If there's something they won't eat, it won't matter. The biological activity is going to break it down anyway. So now we're getting free feed for the fly. We're taking the fly larva. We're feeding it to ducks or chickens or fish. They're all great feed sources for that. And then we have the frost. And the frost is basically the black soldier fly manure, right? But, you know, frost sounds less, you know, off-putting than maggot shit, which is what they – so it's black soldier fly larva. So maggots, and they're frost, so they're poop, right? Well, it's a decent fertilizer as it sits. But if we take the frost and then we put the frost through a worm bin, like red wigglers or something, and we let those guys, compost worms, take it to another level, the resulting compost is extremely valuable, and I would sell that as my product. I would rather sell this as a BSL that was then vermicomposted, final product, super huge nutrient kick, huge biological kick, than trying to sell the soldier fly larva themselves. Now, you know what they'll eat? Sweet potato vine. They'll eat the crap out of it. They will not eat the vine, actually, is what I'm saying, the leaf, right? Black soldier fly will eat that. They will also eat water hyacinth. They'll eat azolla, and they'll eat duckweed. What BSL want nothing to do with is lignin. If you feed them grass, if you feed them, try to feed them hay or straw, they don't want anything to do with it. Pretty much, they want something you would eat if it wasn't nasty. Worms, the thing you have to be careful with worms, if you're using like grasses and stuff like that, you can actually heat the worm bin up. You get that nitrogen-carbon bond going, typical compost, and you can cook your worms to death. But worms will eat your carbons like crazy because they don't actually eat them. Worms don't actually eat the food you put in the worm farm. I know you think they do. I know you think I'm lying to you right now, but I'm not. They may get a little bit here or there of the slurry off of it, but what worms are really doing is they're cultivating microbes. Microbes are breaking down the food, and they're eating the waste product from the microbes and the microbes themselves. Worms are ranchers, not farmers. Ranchers raise animals, right? And farmers raise plants, fruits, and vegetables, and things like that. So the worms are actually raising microbiological life and maintaining them and then feeding off of their product. That's what worms are doing. Anyway, hope we wrap this up pretty well for you guys today. I hope you guys, and I wanted to get it done early enough in the year that there's plenty of time for making slips. And I don't care where you are right now, there's plenty of time for making slips. You can use the links that I provided today in the audio version to learn more if you want to. Or you can just go out and find stuff for yourself. But I really encourage you to try making your own slips. I think you'll actually get better results because you can't come down on a supplier that mails you a product that's in the mail for 3 days and doesn't look very happy about it when it was never designed to be in the mail for 3 days. And you can do it, and they'll be just fine. As long as you take if you get those things in the mail and they're all sad looking and you go stick them in your garden and the sun's up, they'll die. But as long as you put them in some water, kind of bring them back around, get them all happy again, give them some shade and give them some time to heal in before you let them have full sun, they'll be fine. But you'll get better results if you do it yourself. Just figure out which grocery stores around you care enough to make sure they pretty much have everything with an organic option. And if you go buy an organic sweet potato that actually is organic and you do what I said, it will propagate. Again, simple solution, soak the potato overnight in water, plant the potato with just the top exposed in a good loose potting mix and give it some time. And different varieties will have different amounts of time. Some will start to produce within a week. Some will take 2 or 3 weeks before they start to produce. All of them, once they start producing, you start throwing it like crazy. And if you're not sure and you want to hedge your bet, whatever variety you get at least two, right? Get at least two, and that way you're going to end up with at least one of them probably producing for you. if you can't find a variety in organic and you want to grow it, get, you know, they're cheap. Get three or four of them, and one of them at least will probably make slips for you. Last thing on slips, we're making clones. There's not a lot of genetic diversity here. Almost all sweet potatoes are grown from slips commercially, and hence they're all clones. So when you look in the bin of sweet potatoes and there's a great big fat one and a little bitty one, the little bitty one probably has the exact same genetics as the fat one. It was just set later in the season. And when they commercially harvest, obviously they're not going to like put him back and let him keep going. When everybody comes out, everybody comes out. What does that mean? Since they sells by the pound, buy the little one. But the other thing that I've noticed, and I'm not sure why, but the smaller ones tend to produce faster and more slips than the great big ones. So when we harvest our own, I try to always save some of the smaller ones to actually use for propagation. I went completely opposite in the beginning because I didn't really think about that. But when I was forced to use some smaller ones, I'm like, wait a minute, these work just as good or better. And so if you're buying them from a store as your seed stock, buy smaller ones, you pay less money, you get just as many slips. And it will also be a lot cheaper than to buy three or four of a particular variety to hedge your bet on propagation than to buy three or four big ones. Anyway, with that, I don't think there's any more questions. We're going to wrap up. Tomorrow, we're going to be doing another Just Jack show because it's a Tuesday. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about Bitcoin. Oh, no. Yeah, we're going to talk about Bitcoin, and we need to keep talking about Bitcoin. I'm not going to leave you alone about Bitcoin. I've only been on your ass about Bitcoin since 2013, and all of you special people that fight me on it, all fighting me has done it to you is made you less wealthy. I'm not going to say it's made you poor, but it's made you less because some of you probably ain't poor. But ignoring me about Bitcoin has just made you not as wealthy as you could be. And we are in a crossroads place for Bitcoin right now, but I'm going to talk about it in a way I've never talked about it before. Bitcoin is money. That's going to be tomorrow's show. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a lot of things that people say about Bitcoin, including pro-Bitcoin people, and we're going to show you, once you accept Bitcoin is money, how stupid what they say really sounds, including me, because I don't often qualify what I mean enough. When I say never sell your Bitcoin, right, or never spend your Bitcoin, Jack, do you take Bitcoin? Yes, I do, right? I didn't say I wouldn't take it. I said I would spend it. But when I say never spend your Bitcoin, I am going to the extreme to make you realize how important it is that you hold on to the most valuable assets you hold as long as possible, because something that increases in value, the longer you hold it, the better you do. So if I have US dollars and I have Bitcoin and I have to spend one of them, and one of them, you know, inflates at 2 to 10% per year, and the other one keeps deflating as far as value, meaning that it becomes worth more per unit, I want to spend the one that keeps getting its value eroded. So that's why I say that, because otherwise it'd be say like never spend your money. See how dumb that sounds? Sounds really dumb, doesn't it? Never spend your money. Jack Spirko says never spend your money. Well, then all you have is money and no stuff. You can't eat. You don't have a house. You can't pay your electric bill. See, you got problems there. So even when I say that, what I'm always really saying is spend your hardest money last. Have a good reason for it. I just advised somebody last week, yeah, I would sell some Bitcoin to do what you want to do. I'll tell you more about it tomorrow when we get in that episode. But the other side of it, you know, is there's a lot of things that people say that are anti-Bitcoin people that also sound equally stupid when we just change it to money. Because that's what Bitcoin is. It's hard money. So we're going to come at it from that angle tomorrow. And we're going to talk a little bit more, too, about the DCA Everyday Challenge that I have out. I haven't been doing as good a job posting my screenshots, but trust me, and I'll start doing it again every day on my phone about 9 o'clock in the morning. It says your daily purchase has been made from Strike, $5 worth of Bitcoin, $150 a month. Every single day, like clockwork, it just happens. That dollar cost averaging by the day instead of by the week or the month is really, really powerful. And in those small bites, it doesn't hurt. It amazes me how many people say, well, I can't buy Bitcoin. It's too expensive. It's too expensive. While they're holding a Starbucks cup. And I'm like, dummy, if you would have started doing what I'm telling you to do right now back in 2013, you'd be a millionaire from it. I'm not even kidding either. So we're going to keep hammering on that subject as well. What we talk about on the show more than anything else is actually building wealth into your life. Bitcoin is a monetary wealth, a homestead, or something like being able to propagate your own sweet potatoes is another form of wealth. It can be exchanged for some financial gain, but every calorie I grow is one I don't have to buy. Every calorie I grow that one of my animals eats is another calorie I don't have to buy. And then what the animal produces that I eat is another calorie I don't have to buy. So really, we are a lifestyle design wealth accumulation podcast. We call it the survival podcast because nobody would tune in for what I just said, even though people tune in all the time for it, and we call it something else. With that, I'll catch you guys tomorrow with another episode.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.